The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And I am back, sort of, in South Island, New Zealand, in the North Canterbury region. I wish I was there now, not here in Toronto when I'm recording this. Still cold weather. And also, I'm not going to lie, I miss our time in South Island, New Zealand. Joined by winemaker for Forager Wine, was working at Greystone for ages, a guy that is I would say maybe a winemaker's winemaker, two-time winner for the best winemaker in New Zealand. It is Dom Maxwell. Dom, thank you so much for being on the pod today.
Thanks, Matt. Yeah, it's great to join you. And look forward to our chat.
We never got a chance to meet in person when I was there. Everyone was pointing towards you. And it was like, oh, you got to go to Forager. You got to go to Greystone. You have to go to these places. So I'm glad we're able to talk now. And we'll start with the beginning and work our way from there. How did you first fall in love with wine?
Well, I think it was a gradual thing, you know. There was an interest from my late teens. And I had a bit of exposure to it when I was at uni studying commerce, and holiday jobs were spent doing some agricultural work out near Lincoln University, and at a friend's farm, and they had a small vineyard and big dreams. And most of the time working in their vineyard was spent talking about their big dreams. And they were a really cool couple. So I guess that got a bit of the romanticist side going, you know, and things sort of flowed from there. We moved over to London as backpackers after our after studying. I think what I saw over there was just a connection to the wine world that at that stage didn't exist. It's certainly not for me in New Zealand. So that was both in London, but then just access obviously to wider Europe, and it's just so easy to get there, you know. And wine was everywhere. It wasn't necessarily just for a certain part of society. There were obviously different wines that were drunk in different parts of society, but that exposure just grew over there. And I think that was sort of the point where I decided that it was worth looking into.
So you worked at a small vineyard with big dreams. I kind of feel that if you did that on the Forager website, you could kind of have that at the masthead to kind of describe what you're doing today.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? I mean, it's I think the big dreams are there definitely, but I always tend to think in quite small steps just in front of me, and I think that's probably it's not a daunting way to go, and also it leads you to discovery as well. But I totally get what you're saying, absolutely. Particularly after a glass or two, you know, those dreams get bigger.
Oh, they do. And they get more attainable. That second glass of wine, you know you're going to make something that's going to be at Odd Bins and at every top wine store in London after that second glass of Chardonnay. We'll get there. But I'm curious, just in my research, you worked harvests. And I'm wondering, what were the lessons you learned? Burgundy, Rheingau in Germany and Oregon, very unique, different sort of parts of the world to make wine. I'm wondering things you took away from those three different areas.
Yeah, they were really formative experiences. I took different things away each time. There was a theme across them all, and you saw the importance of certain things. It was a thread within that. So, you know, Oregon was great. It was, I guess, where I learned about camaraderie, people, community, obviously how to make great wine, but it was more about, for me, the takeaways were, you know, a team and community and all these things that are so important in making wine, and how it really does take a huge amount of coming together to achieve that. The importance of food ran through all three of those experiences, and I think you see that in wine regions around the world, how food and wine, they go together, and one affects the other. Yeah, I mean, Germany was a slightly different experience. It was you know, I was working for a place that made 12 Rieslings. That's all we made. Obviously I went there because, you know, Riesling is an important part of North Canterbury, and, you know, the tradition in the Rheingau is phenomenal. So it was quite a technical harvest, I would say. And actually all three harvests were in tricky conditions, so you do tend to learn a bit through that time. So certainly took away a lot of technical expertise from my time in Germany. And I think Burgundy was where perhaps I saw a philosophy being lived, you know, day to day, and just deep-rooted within the way they operate and how they viewed a vineyard, more than just a place where grapes came from and then you made the wine. It was, I think, a realization for me that it all is about the place. And so it helped me massively develop my own philosophy around approach, in particular to Pinot Noir.
Yeah, we'll get to Isolated Hill and all of that in a little bit. You said you worked some tricky harvests. What constitutes a tricky harvest?
Yeah, or special harvests, as I've learned to call them.
Is that for marketing?
Yeah.
Is that for the marketing? Oh, it's a special harvest. We're not making much wine this year. It was that special.
That's right. That's right. It's very special. Wet weather ran through all three of those harvests, you know, and actually I think conditions leading up to the Oregon harvest were reasonably good, but it was just rain right throughout. The same in the Rheingau and the same in Burgundy. But the wines that came out of those vintages from those wineries were beautiful wines. And so that was another learning curve to experience. Yeah.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that. In Niagara, we're big Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, Gamay, Riesling, and Cab Franc. I would say those are the five big grapes. And 2020 was hot and a beautiful, easy harvest. And it was great for the Bordeaux varietals. But the Pinot's sometimes a little bit big. 2021 was a horrible year, was wet. And every winemaker I talked to hated 2021, but they love the 2021 Pinot Noirs. To your point that a wet, shitty harvest often leads to a great Pinot Noir.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you know, you learn as you go that heat isn't always our friend. And I think about one of the probably highest quality vintages we've had here in North Canterbury for a lot of vineyards, not all vineyards, but was 2012. And it was very cold, but it was dry as well, you know. So there wasn't that rain to cause disease, but it was just such a gradual ripening of the fruit that the depth of flavor and detail that came through by the time the sugars were there was exceptional, you know. And so I see that, and often, you know, in those cooler regions when you get rain, you know, the weather's cool as well. And so you're picking at perhaps a slightly lower sugar level. And what you see is detail in the wine, which perhaps at those bigger sugar levels can be harder to see.
So how do you, let's jump a little bit ahead. How did you get to Greystone? What were those early years like?
Oh, amazing. Yeah, they were great. I was finishing a postgrad diploma at Lincoln Uni. I'd gone back to study there, and there was, you know, there were a few ads pinned up to the wall at the end of the year at uni, just outside the winery lab. You know, there was opportunities there around the country, and historically there's not a lot of opportunity in North Canterbury because it's small. You know, there's maybe 15 wineries, more vineyards, but there was one position or two positions going at a new vineyard that was going in. At the time, the vineyard was called Limestone Creek Vineyard. It's now Greystone. It was just a name change after a couple of years. It was the local wine region. You know, we were happy living in Christchurch, and so yeah, went up for an interview. Look, and it was a vineyard hand job. So, you know, I had a degree, postgrad diploma, but I was, you know, going up for a job that was paying minimum wage. But I couldn't have been more excited, you know, because it was a first foot in the door, full time job. So, a couple of us from the course got a job there. And as soon as I went in the front gate at Greystone, you could see the potential, you know, like the vines were just going in, but it was a really ambitious and still remains so project. You know, you could tell if you worked hard, there might be some opportunity there, you know, to grow your own career there, which is kind of what happened.
You had an incredibly successful career there. I think twice you won New Zealand Winemaker of the Year working at Greystone. By the way, off topic for a second, do you think at universities, do they still pin things on a board for job opportunities, or is everything online now?
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, because a couple of years ago we were looking for some interns, and I suggested that we do that, you know, sort of got some sideways looks, but we did do it. We got no applications, which probably just goes to show that everyone's probably walking past that board with their head down in their phone. So, flipping through on one job. So I really like that tactile real life stuff. So I'll never let it go.
No, oh no, neither will I. Everyone's scrolling on Instagram, and I want to get to Forager, but I want people to know a little bit about Greystone, because for this pod, I'm a huge fan of New Zealand wines. I fell in love with North Island 10, 15 years ago, and eventually, obviously, South Island Pinots and Chards and Rieslings, and by the way, Bone Line, killer Cab Franc as well. But what do people need to know about the wines of Greystone, which are a little bit easier to get than your wines?
Yeah. Well, Greystone's a hillside property. It's about 40 hectares planted on 120 hectare property. Just by that, you can tell that they've been very selective as to where they've planted a range of varieties, but Pinot Noir, Chardonnay being the main two, I guess, sort of the heroes of the vineyard, with support from the aromatics, Riesling, Gris, and Sauvignon. But I think one of the things that makes Greystone interesting is its philosophical approach that's developed over the years. Greystone adopted organic grape growing, winemaking, 12 years ago now. And then soon after sort of really integrated a regenerative viticultural approach. Sheep had always been used in the vineyard from day one, but that attention and focus on that was really ratcheted up as a way to reduce the amount that people were doing in the vineyard, and just see how much harmony could be brought in from the natural environment, I guess, but also the sheep that were already performing a role in the vineyard. So, you know, there are a lot of things that were learnt through that time. But overall, I think what we saw was a reduce in impact on the soil, increase in health, which I think is massive when you're running an organic vineyard, because it can be quite a devigorating situation. And so huge learnings through that time. And as a result, you know, the wines are really site-driven, textural. We've always tried to make them layered and food wines. You know, even though I've moved on from Greystone, though, it'll always, you know, remain dear to my heart, and, you know, always enjoy drinking those wines.
Yeah, so let's go to 2012. What was the motivation? What was the final decision where you were still making wine, but then you wanted to start your own label, and you decided to start Forager? I'm wondering what 2012 was all about for you.
I mean, I've always had an interest. Like I say, I studied commerce originally, and I've always had an interest in having my own business. And it was really that straightforward. You know, I'd love to have my own small wine business. And I wasn't that keen on perhaps bringing in outside investment or other people. I just wanted it to be a little personal project. And so, back in 2012, I said to, you know, the management group at Greystone, I'd like to do this, including the owner, Peter. And, you know, they always took a very progressive sort of approach with that stuff. And, they're very supportive, as they have been with other staff who've wanted to, you know, try small ventures along the way. And I think it's mutually beneficial, actually. So that was 2012, two barrels, I think, which is kind of where it hovered for about 4 years, before I found Isolated Hill Vineyard.
And we'll get to Isolated Hill, but actually thinking about it, I think winery owners, I think it makes so much sense for them, especially in newer areas like North Canterbury, not as famous as Otago, you know, not as famous as some other parts in New Zealand or Marlborough, Sauvignon Blanc. When the owners allow the winemakers to go make their own wine, and then someone tries your wine and goes, oh, that's damn good. Oh, and you used to work at Greystone. Oh, let me go check out Greystone. Like, it feels like it just expands, and it just, I think it helps the credibility of the entire area.
Yeah, and I think it can kind of become a bit of a melting pot for innovation and ideas as well, because I had an idea of some things I wanted to try with Forager, and once I shared those ideas with the team at Greystone, their response was, well, let's try that here too. But perhaps if I hadn't have started Forager, we never would have tried those things at Greystone. And many of them have been pretty cool things to do that have helped sort of forge that sort of philosophy at Greystone ahead.
And we will get to the open vineyard fermentation. I want to geek out about that in a second. But let's actually, I want to ask you about where you source your grapes from, Isolated Hill. But I'll ask it in a different way. How difficult would it be as a tourist to use Waze to find where it is you get your grapes from?
Well, these days, there's a funny story. You can find through Google Maps, I think you can plug it in, Isolated Hill, and it's going to point you to a very isolated spot a long way from probably where you are at that time. Effectively, it's on a big farm, but it's a very small vineyard. And the owners of that farm, from time to time, get people driving up their driveway wanting to do a wine tasting because they've seen it. The pin is dropped on Google Maps at their farm. They always, if they're home, they'll have a bit of a chat and that sort of thing. Legally, they can't do much. But, certainly they can point out the vineyard and that sort of thing. So, yeah, people will find it. It's amazing.
Because I remember reading about it. It's certainly out of the way. What is it about that site that inspired you, or that you wanted to source grapes from there?
I was really keen on a site that was a bit different. This site, it really is. It's about 30 odd minutes from the nearest vineyard, and about 45 minutes away from Waipara, which is the main sort of grape growing area of North Canterbury. It's on the same hillside as an operational limestone quarry. So that sort of talks to how chalky that soil is, that land is. And it's on a pretty steep hillside. So, it's got a lot of great stuff going for it. But I think the clincher are the people that own the vineyard, So going and meeting them, Andy and Jill, and the way they operate, everything's just done on a handshake. It has been for 10 years now, but we've always backed each other. They'd be more than happy to do what I needed to be done on the vineyard to get the fruit required, and vice versa. I'm more than happy to get in there and help, and obviously, pay a premium and to support them. So it's mutually beneficial. Not only financially, but I think from a point of view of fulfillment, the vineyard for them is small, but it's about satisfaction and about following a passion for them. So it has to be a relationship, a friendship, and that's what's formed over that time, and that's what's kept me there as much as the quality of fruit.
Well, it must be great for them. These are farmers, and the product they're making is making incredible wines that people are gobbling up. It's not like you've got tons of your product sitting waiting. So it's a very popular wine that you make, and that must make them feel great. But also, I guess it also speaks to, you have to have this good relationship, because I imagine you want them to do certain techniques, whether it's with yield or pruning. So there must be some give and take where they trust you and you trust them, because you say, I need this from you, and there's going to be concessions they're going to want back, I imagine.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, they're very keen for it to work. I mean, they want to see great wine at the end of the day come out. And so, yeah, it's very open. It's very open, open, honest, good-natured, friendly, and at times heartbreaking if the weather's rough. But that's what a friendship can be about sometimes. So, but that the vineyard ties us together. It's great.
So, Dom, if people see the words vineyard ferment on a bottle of wine, and we'll say more specifically on a bottle of your wine, what does that mean?
It's a good question. I'm glad you asked it, actually, because often it's just misinterpreted as wild ferment, which It is. But what it means is that the fruit is fermented in the vineyard. So at picking, it goes into a vat, into a fermenter in the vineyard. So it doesn't go to the winery. It stays out in the vineyard for its whole time on skins, which is predominantly taken up by fermentation. And where we are, that's around 4 weeks. So it doesn't see a winery until around a month after harvest. So vineyard ferment means that it goes through that formative time in the vineyard. Yeah, such a transition from fruit to wine, and for it to happen out there where the fruit grew in that environment, the environment that trying to showcase and show and provide a window through to look at. Yeah, that's what it means. It means literally fermented and rested out there amongst the vines.
And then I want to stay on this because it's fascinating. This is the first time I've seen this. And you said in another interview, it is truly fermenting all by itself on the side of this hillside. But it shows you, and we've learned a lot from these ferments, that we intervene because we can, and it is not always because we should. I'm wondering if you could expand on that quote and just the role of this style of fermentation when it comes to making your wine.
I've learned a lot doing this, and my approach has evolved over time as my trust, my understanding, I guess, has grown in what we don't need to do, I think, you know. I guess what I'm saying in that quote really is that there's very little you can do when the fruit is fermenting on the side of a hillside. There's no temperature control. There's no cupboard with winery additives just to the side. There's no electricity to use a pump for a pump over. So really, you're just allowing the grapes to sit there and ferment. And I think in the early years, the very first time I did it, sort of going back, the approach with the vineyard ferment was to do what I'd done in the winery. So, you know, process the grapes, add a small amount of sulfur, and then plunge. But, you know, I think very quickly I started to realize that actually by allowing it to ferment in the vineyard, what I really want to do is strip away human influence. And so therefore, not making any additions became really important. Obviously, we can't heat or cool down. So was really about accepting that nature is going to have its own way of making this wine. And the amazing thing that sort of happened was actually the wine was really beautiful. And so I realized that we don't really need to intervene when the fruit is good, you know. Perhaps when the fruit is you know, compromised, then, yeah, the wine should be made in the winery and sort of more closely attended. But, you know, when the fruit is great, you can really let nature take its course. And I think the finesse of tannins, the complexity of aromas, I think the texture element for me were massive game changers as far as structure and characteristics in the wine compared to, you know, when it was made in the winery. I mean, one of the things that you see in the vineyard ferments is that exposure to not only the vineyard yeast. So you have a wide range of yeast performing the fermentation for a longer period of time than you do in the winery. But you see the influence of temperature, and temperature's got a massive part to play in, you know, color, aroma, structure, tannins in wine. And so by allowing nature to completely control that temperature, there's no roof over the top of this fermenter. That fermenter's going to be really in tune with the season. If it's a warm harvest, fermentation is going to get underway pretty quickly. That's going to affect color, aroma. But if it's a cool harvest, fermentation, you know, we've waited for up to 12 days before for fermentation to start because it's been picked on a cool day. It's taken a long time to warm up. And so I think from that point of view, allowing the fruit to have a whole nother month of seasonal influence became quite a fascinating thing for me. And so when you line those wines up vintage to vintage, you know, maybe 6-8 vintages, you so clearly see that vintage come through. And I've grown to love that and actually accept that we don't always need this 4 to 5 day cold soak. We don't always need a peak of, 32 degrees. We can actually let temperature fluctuate. If you've got really great fruit quality, the quality will be inherent and will come through in the wine.
You must have just wild vintage variations for like just every year, which I imagine could make it hard to sell if you're selling it to mass amounts of people that want some sort of safety in terms of the quality of the wine guarantee or the style guarantee the same year after year. For you, that must be, so fascinating just how different each vintage is.
I love it. I really love it. Yeah. I mean, it's going to change every year, but I love that. I really do. It feels right. And the whole point of a season in wine is that it's different from the previous year. We put the vintage on the front of the label for a reason, because it's important. The vintage variation is far bigger than if it's made conventionally inside a winery. But those wines can be so surprising, like a warm vintage might, because you get a quick ferment, less cold soak time. Often the wines are more opaque in color. And so, it's so fun to see people try those wines because textural elements are still there. The tension from the fruit is still there. But perhaps some of those more traditional sort of quality markers that we've tried to obtain over time, they become less important with this wine. Yeah, I really love that. And also, for me, there's actually a letting go as well, which is really pleasing. I'm not big on putting a lot of pressure on myself, and I couldn't think of anything worse than trying to create the same thing every year. If nature's willing to do it, then I'm more than happy to let her do it and just nurture it along the way. So, it's great to be able to tell that story, but it's not necessarily me making that wine.
Well, you're more the steward of it, but still, like, where did this idea come from? Because it I imagine it's certainly not a mainstream idea just to let everything ferment out in the wild, for lack of a better term.
Yeah. So a couple of things happened. In 2011, Greystone purchased a neighboring property called Muddy Water, been around for a long time, because Muddy Water had a winery. Before that, I was making the Greystone wines at a contract facility. I was wild fermenting at that contract facility. Went to Muddy Water, same approach, wild fermenting. And then something happened that year, 2011. I noticed the ferments were different, and even the character of the wines was slightly different. But this is fruit from the same vineyard, Greystone Vineyard, but they've just been fermented in two different places, but still, technically wild ferments. And at about that same time, there are a few people starting to do Peter Coups, so getting their buckets of crushed grapes going just prior to picking the main lot. And then using that to pitch in to their main fermenter in the winery once that little bucket ferment got going. So both these things were, I guess, just floating around in my head. And I thought, well, that sounds really interesting. The one downside that I could think of at that time was that the fruit is still in the winery. Even if you are pitching a bucket in, there is inevitably still going to be some influence of perhaps other yeast in the winery from other ferments. So the simple idea was, well, what if we just don't bring it into the winery? What if we just leave it out there? And that's where it came from. And it was a very simple, naive sort of look at it. But like I said earlier on, like I tried to think about the next step as opposed to too many steps down the line. Obviously, when you need to, you do, right? But with some of these things, it was just worth giving a go, and it was started off all about yeast, all about the yeast that was in the environment, and learned a lot about that. But alongside that, I've also learned massively about the influence of temperature on making Pinot Noir. So yeah.
By the way, we only have a couple minutes left, and I feel bad, like, because I just wanted to geek out a little bit more on the vinification and viticulture of what you're doing with your winery Forager. What do people need to know about Forager? In terms of, probably won't be able to find it too much in Toronto, Canada, but in terms of your portfolio, what you make?
Yeah, so started off making Pinot Noir, one Pinot Noir, and from Isolated Hill. More recently, I've added a second Pinot Noir, yet to be released, but off another limestone property called Kokowai. So two limestone single vineyard Pinot Noirs. I also make a wine called Little Forager, which is more of a village style. So it's small parcels from a number of small vineyards. Everything is pretty small scale. And more recently, Limestone Hill has been harvesting Chardonnay that was planted 6 years ago as well. So that Chardonnay has been added into the mix, naturally fermented. And the idea is just treating the fruit with respect and restraint and letting it sing, really letting it speak of its place. And there'll be some other varieties to come or other interpretations to come, but the philosophy remains the same.
As we end this, what advice would you give to people that love wine or food and just are in North Canterbury, are in your neck of the woods, where they should go, what they should do? As I said, I'm a massive fan of your area, you know, just in the wines that are made, but for people that are thinking of traveling there.
Go and immerse yourselves. You know, like we're really lucky in this area that often at the cellar door, you're going to meet someone who's part of the family who owns that vineyard or that winery. It's a small region made up of small producers who, although the wines are quite different from each other, they actually hold a similar philosophy, and that's, you know, really letting their place sing. And food is a massive part of what we do. So, you know, it's a great area for truffles, for seafood, and it's quite a diverse area as well. It's not all about the grapes. There's still a lot of sheep farming and crop farming as well. So, yeah, immerse yourself in the food as well as the wine.
Dom, really appreciate it. Congrats on the success, on your curiosity, on your experiments that are working out. I wish you nothing but the best, and I hope sometime that I'll be able to find myself a couple bottles of a Forager somewhere down the road. Really appreciate you being on the pod today.
Thanks very much, Matt. Yeah, it's great to chat, and yeah. Who knows, maybe some Forager will make its way over to Ontario one day.
Are you listening, wine distributors? Anyway, thank you so much, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Apple, on iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.